Hey, it's Jed Hearn, host of Wizards, Warriors, and Words. If you're enjoying the writing advice on this show, you might like my new podcast, The Jed Hearn Show, where every week I share the best fantasy writing advice that I've learned from publishing 3 fantasy novels and a best-selling video game. There's over 12 episodes that you can listen to right away, including my top 10 fantasy books of all time, how to make fantasy names that don't suck, 2 rules that make writing effortless, and my complete summaries of Brandon Sanderson's and Neil Gaiman's writing classes, and much more. Check it out by searching for The Jed Hearn Show in your podcast app.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Wizards, Warriors and Words, a fantasy writing advice podcast. I'm Jed Hearn, author of Siege of Trebolin, and I'm joined by my fellow writers, starting with Dirk Ashton.
I am Dirk Ashton, author of the Paternus Trilogy.
Michael R. Fletcher.
Hi, that's me, author of, I don't know, some books. It's too early for this shit.
And Rob J. Hayes.
Hello, I'm Rob J. Hayes, author of Titan Hoppers, the progression out science now. Fantasy, which released yesterday, although by the time this airs, it will probably be like last week or something.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, I got my copy.
That book looks sick. We should definitely do an episode talking about that a bit more in more detail later, because that looks really cool. But today we are joined by a very special guest, Mike Carey. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So, Mike, just for readers and listeners who might not be familiar with your work, do you want to just introduce yourself and talk a little bit about some of the stuff that you've written over the years?
Yeah, sure. So I write comics, I write novels and short stories, I write screenplays, occasionally other stuff like radio plays and game scripts. Started out mainly writing comics, and I'm probably still best known for Lucifer at DC Vertigo. But in prose fiction, I'm best known for The Girl with All the Gifts, a zombie novel with a cute little girl zombie as the protagonist, which was filmed with Gemma Arterton and Senya Nanowa.
Fantastic. We're going to be talking about sort of writing comics and graphic novels in this episode, but I think the thing that really stood out to me the most when I was kind of doing research for this is just how much stuff you've written over the years. Like, how are you so prolific? Because you've probably written like hundreds of things. It's crazy.
Yeah. I think my secret weapon there is insecurity. As soon as I gave up teaching, I was a teacher for 15 years and was just writing around the edges of that. As soon as I gave up the day job, which was back in 1999, I immediately sort of felt like I'd fallen off the edge of a cliff. You know, that the first month when a salary check didn't come in, I started to panic, and I don't think I've ever really stopped. So I'm always, Dirk is still holding up my stuff. Amazing. I'm always looking for the job after next and the job after that. I'm always sort of like trying to drum up work. I never say no to work, or almost never. So yeah, it's pure panic. Panic is a great incentive.
A great motivator. Other Mike and Rob, can you guys speak a bit to that as full-time writers?
It's non-stop panic. You just, each month you look at your Amazon sales and think, oh, fuck, come on, buy books.
Come on, do it. Yeah. What about you,
funnily
Rob?
Enough, that's exactly why you sort of like, you keep writing because you're like, well, yeah, okay, sales have dropped a little bit, so maybe I should write another book. And then before you know it, you have like six series on the go at the same time and you have no idea what you're writing.
That's the challenge, isn't it? The sort of like keeping multiple things on the go, trying to sort of mix and match deadlines, especially, you know, writing in different media because they all have their different sort of life cycles and periodicities.
What did you start with, Mike? I mean, you've done comics, do you do short stories also?
Yeah, I've got one collection of short stories out. I've written maybe 20.
I don't have that.
Publishing. It was a very, very small limited edition by a boutique publisher, by a really, really, really good small indie publisher in the UK, PS Publishing. I started out doing comics journalism. I started out writing reviews and articles for fanzines. And then at a certain point, I started. I got to know some guys who were editing comics through that. So I pitched some stuff to them. You probably don't remember a very, very short-lived British comic called Toxic with an exclamation mark. It lasted for 31 issues between, I think, 1990 and 1991. It was set up as a rival to 2000 AD. And they didn't do their sums right, and they went bankrupt very fast. But in the brief period when they existed, I pitched two books to them. One was a psychological horror called Legions of Hell, and the other was a superhero story that was shamelessly ripped off from Watchmen, which was called Aquarius. And they commissioned both, and then they went out of business. They went bankrupt, which was kind of a that was setting the tone for things to come. There was a point back there where if any small publisher hired me, they just immediately hit the tube. what Jonah did to shipping, I did to independent publishers.
Oh, that's great.
that had to be tough. I mean, a lot of people would have just given up, you know, after one or two, just one of those, let alone a couple. So
it was tough. I mean, I guess it was just a hobby back then. I mean, it was always depressing when I thought I got a foot in the door or thought I got something published and then the publisher died. But it was just something I was doing around the edges of teaching. It was not a career, and I didn't think it ever would be a career. So I worked my way through. So after Toxic and Apocalypse Press over here, I went to Malibu just before they were bought out by Marvel and ceased trading. I worked for Caliber in the last days of Caliber. But that was kind of a turning point. The stuff I did for Caliber was much more significant than I thought it was. They didn't pay me, you know, most of the time. They had this charming policy that they would only pay for a book if it went into profit. So you'd write your script. You'd write your script and send it in, and then they'd say, wow. Yeah, we took a bath on that one, so we're not paying you. But they did bring the books out, and the production values were really good. They were really, really solid black and white books on good paper stock. So I started to build up a portfolio, and I started to send stuff into Vertigo. Specifically, I sent them into Elisa Quitney, who was editing Sandman at the time. I sent so many begging letters. Lisa Quitney, it was incredible. Just, you know, please, please, please let me work for you. And then one day she wrote back. And that was sort of my big break, although it was 2 years, another two years before I got any work commissioned at DC. But that was where I started to build up a relationship there.
And was that what led to you working on Lucifer? Because I'd really love to talk about that.
Eventually it did. Yeah. So what happened was Elisa wrote to me and said, you know, it's great that you've been sending me your stuff. It's great that you've finally figured out that you should send a return address. why don't you pitch some? I did so many things wrong. But she said they were going to launch The Dreaming as a kind of continuation of the Sandman universe. And she invited me to pitch stories for that. And I spent 2 years doing that, like pitching, doing one page and two page pitches for The Dreaming. And then Caitlin Keenan took it over as a continuity book. So Elisa said, "Now that's off the table now." And I just sort of drifted back into limbo for a while. But then I did a book at Caliber called Dr. Faustus, which is an adaptation of the Christopher Marlowe play. Dr. Faustus, but just a retelling of the Faust legend that's a bit more upfront about the homosexual, the gay subtext, which I think is definitely there in Marlowe's work. So in this, it becomes a kind of almost like a love triangle between Faustus, his servant Wagner, and the demon Mephistopheles. And Elisa sort of picked that up off the slush pile, and she called me again. And this time she said that they were starting Sandman Presents and they needed somebody to do a Lucifer script. But the thing is, they'd already hired a writer, and they'd already had a sort of like a script for issue one, and then they'd cashiered the writer. It was Elizabeth Hahn. They greenlit the script, and then they decided very late in the day that although it was a really good script, it wasn't a good vehicle for Lucifer, or somebody at DC felt that. So they, at the last moment, they wanted to go with a different writer. She called me up and she said, "Do you want to do this?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "You're going to have to want it badly, because we need a pitch in 48 hours, and we probably need the first script within a fortnight." So I just didn't sleep that weekend, hammered out the kind of pitch for what became Morningstar option, sent it in.
Wow.
Elisa liked it, Karen liked it, Neil Gaiman liked it, which was crucial because he was the script consultant on all of those Sandman projects. And they gave me the green light.
That's awesome.
And what was that process? First of all, that is amazing. Thank you for sharing that. I really wanted to know a little bit about how you approach working in another writer's universe or other writers' universes. Because I think with The Sandman, you know, what I love so much about that comic and that series is the kind of unique tone of Neil Gaiman's world building in that original series. And I'm really curious to know how you are able to kind of capture enough of that original ethos when you're doing your own take on it, but also have your own unique voice that you're bringing into it as well. So what is that process sort of like? And you can talk about other comics where you've worked in shared universes before if you want.
I was a lot younger back then, and I was brash and stupid, and it never occurred to me to be afraid that I was following Neil. I just thought, you know, This is going to be the most fun I'm ever going to have in my life. I was a huge Sandman fan. I was obsessive about Sandman because I felt, and I still feel, I still think this is true, that Sandman had done something in long form storytelling in comics that hadn't been done before.
Yes,
mm-hmm. In a way it picks up on what Alan Moore was doing in Swamp Thing, but I think it takes it further. Yeah, it's a novelistic approach. Over the 7 years that he was writing Sandman, he basically told one story, but he wove it together out of many, many different threads, using the long arcs and the done in one issues to kind of strike sparks off each other. And a lot of those sort of freestanding stories seemed to be independent of the main story, and then they would feed in from unexpected angles later on. I'd never seen that done before. I don't think it had ever been done before in a mainstream book. So I just thought, well, I'm going to get me some of that. All I ever did with Lucifer to start with, and I think you can definitely see this in the first year of the book, that was me doing Neil, me just pastiching Neil. It took me quite a while to sort of like to build up the confidence to sort of like deviate from that script. So I think it's coming back to your question. I think I'm always kind of. I come from a position where I'm very respectful of continuity. You can see it in my X-Men. You can see it in my Hellblazer. You know, in Hellblazer, I took a lot of the characters that had been created during Warren Ellis's very brief run on the book and brought them back into the spotlight. On X-Men, I took a whole bunch of B-list and C-list characters that nobody seemed to want to use and sort of brought them forward again. So I really enjoy the challenge of working in continuity in somebody else's universe and sort of finding a new angle to come in at that doesn't destroy or disrespect what's already there. In some cases, I think it was when I was running Hellblazer, someone said on the Straight to Hell forum, "This is like reading Hellblazer fan fiction. It's so indebted to continuity. It's kind of strange." And so I think that's the downside of the way I do it.
Yes.
But I'll always do it immersively. I'll always start by reading everything that's there, which with X-Men was an incredible technical challenge because there were about 5,000 issues of X-Men related material, most of which was either unavailable or stupidly expensive. Marvel would not routinely send you stuff in that back catalog. If you needed a specific issue, they could send you a scan of it. But mostly what I did there was there was a guy on eBay who was selling bootleg CDs of complete runs of Uncanny, complete runs of New Mutants, complete runs of Adjectiveless X-Men. So I bought those, feeling dirty as I did it, read them and then destroyed them because it was the only practical way.
Yes.
To get that to get that material.
Wow.
I mean, these days there are websites where you could go and they're just as sleazy and read them there. But at the time it was that or nothing.
Yeah.
And are you taking notes while you're reading through it? Or are you just reading it, trying to like pick up on the vibe of it? Is there any like kind of tactics that you're using to better understand that world and better try to craft your own approach to telling a story with it?
Yeah. I do take notes as I go, and then as I'm sort of working towards the actual story, my notes take on a very odd form, which is the form of a catechism. I ask myself questions, and then I answer the questions, and then I ask myself follow up questions, and I do that sort of like in actual writing. Yeah, you know, it's weird and schizophrenic, and it's hard to explain why it works, but it does work for me.
So could you give a quick example? Could you just give like a quick example of what that might look like? Say for Lucifer?
Yeah, so it'd be like what if we brought back some of the characters from The Acolytes? Which ones would we use? What would Exodus's motivation be in the post House of M X-Men universe? And then I'll sort of like write a few paragraphs on that, and then I'll pick a fight with myself and say, but that doesn't work.
Sounds familiar.
So do you do that too, Dick?
Oh, yeah. I think we all do. Just question, except for Mike Fletcher. He just knows what he's doing all the time.
He just writes perfection on the first go.
Yeah.
Flawless.
He just sits down and just flows from beginning to end. And it's just like that. He never has any anxiety. It's constant. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. You said you made a lot of mistakes at the beginning. We're all self-pub authors, and that's all we do.
As an example of the kind of mistakes I was making, I was sending pitches to Karen Berger for superhero comics when she was senior editor at Vertigo and had nothing to do with the superhero books at all.
Whoops.
I sent an email to Lindsay Hall and referred to Orbit, even though she had already been out of Orbit and at Tor for a year and a half. It's like, oops.
Ouch.
Okay.
So Rob, it's not just me. Something?
Yeah, to be honest, I want to ask, this is going to sound like a really basic question, but I have no idea how comics and the like work. So when you say you're sort of like, you're pitching a comic, like you're not doing the drawing, you're sort of just writing the story of the comic.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay.
So, I can't draw to save my life. Although, having said that, usually I do draw when I'm scripting. I'll show you. I've got one that's sitting right here.
Oh,
this
cool!
Is a comic I'm doing at the moment. So that's how I start scripting. I do these horrifically awful, rudimentary stick figure drawings for each panel, and I write the dialogue down the side. That's how I start. And then when I go to script, I've made a lot of the creative decisions about page turns, about camera angles, which dialogue goes with which image, and if there are any structural problems, they'll usually come out at that stage. So it's a really useful kind of halfway house. The artist never gets to see that. Because they would just laugh at me and kick sand in my face.
They crucify you.
I was wondering what the difference between the sort of like the mediums of writing for comic and writing for like, you know, a book are, because I've always looked at comics as sort of they're almost like viewing a story through strobe lighting. you're just getting, you know, an image here, an image there, and rather than like a single flowing story. So I just wondered how different it is to write for the two mediums.
And I was thinking about what you were just saying too, Mike. You write basically, I was a screenwriter in the past. So there's a difference between a master scene script, which has no camera direction, has nothing directorial. It's simply dialogue and action, right? And then there's a shooting script that the director usually writes, where he goes in and puts in MCU, CU, wide shot, establishing shot, you know, all these kinds of things, and low angle, right, you know, those kinds of things. So you're actually doing closer to a shooting script?
Yes, that's right. And when I started to do screenwriting, I approached screenplays as though they were comics, and I got a lot of negative feedback about that.
It's a no-no if you're just writing a screenplay to put camera angles in. That's one of the things I really have to hammer into my students. Don't do it.
Because you're doing other people's jobs. I think they're legally entitled. You know, the director can find out where you live, come around and beat you to death with the with the screenplay, and it's not technically homicide.
Book editors have the same deal. If you don't implement their changes, they come around.
when you write a comic script, you are giving, you know, the bulk of it is art direction. It's telling the artist what needs to be in the panels, and giving them a map to get through the story. When I started writing out, started writing comics, there were only two comic scripts that were widely available. One of them was for the Calliope episode of Sandman, which was in the collection Dream Country. And the other one was the script for issue one of Watchmen, which was in the trade paperback collection of Watchmen. So unfortunately for me, I worked from the Watchmen one. So I tried to write like Alan Moore. And the snag with that is it only works for Alan Moore. It doesn't work for anybody else. I don't know if you've actually seen that script, but the first panel is just a little smiley button with a little single drop of blood on it. Just one very simple image. The art direction for that single panel runs to a side and a half of closely typed A4. It's something like 750 words.
Wow. Astonishingly
detailed.
That's crazy.
And that's how he does it throughout. He writes novelistically, but he does it that way because, you know, he already has the page in his head. He knows exactly what effect he's going for, and he gives very, very explicit directions for how to get there. What I found over the space of maybe 2-3 years of writing comics was that, if you're not Alan Moore, it's definitely the case that less is more. That actually what you need to tell the artist is these things in the panel are important, so make sure you get those in. Or even this is the effect I'm going for in this panel, so why don't you figure out a way to do it? You know, you can be imagistic, you can be telegraphic. If you look at a Michael Bendis, Brian Bendis script, the panel description might just be close up Captain America, he's pissed, or something like that. Yeah, that's all you get. You're giving a map of the story. You will often sort of say, you know, this panel's the most important on the page, or you'll say, I want this to be the page turn. But a lot of the time you're trusting the artist to find the visual solution for the story that you're telling. Because surprise, surprise, artists have better visual imaginations than most writers do.
You tend to get more than you ask for. It's like when I had John do the second cover for the Paternus series for Wrath of Gods, and he had in his sketches he had the main character in a man bun, and I'm like, that actually works really well for that character. So I actually went back and no changed one else ever. The description and had him put it up because it looks really cool on that particular character. So I actually changed it in the script, and I've done that before, or in the script, in the manuscript. And I've actually done that probably 3 or 4 times based on what artists come up with.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. It's just about stealing good ideas, right? Doesn't matter influence. If they come from your editor or artist.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's happened to me, sorry, Rob, I keep interrupting you.
No, I think it's the video recording software we're using.
Time-like.
Sometimes it takes a while to come through.
Well, one of the things that's happened to me a few times now is that I'll write a script, and there'll be a description of a character, and then when the character sketches come back, the character looks really different, and immediately I look at the sketches and I think I know how that character's voice works. A good example of that is Gaudium. There's this horrible little imp in Lucifer, Gaudium. He's one of the fallen cherubs. He looks like a gargoyle. And he talks like a New York cab driver. and that's kind of because when Peter drew him, I thought, you know, I could definitely see how that character would talk and act. And initially he was just going to be in one issue. He was going to have a choric function. He was just going to tell another character something she needed to know. But he was so cool, we had to keep bringing him back. And he ended up getting like 3 issues of Lucifer all to himself.
Huh. Nice.
That's pretty cool. Fletcher, I was going to ask, did you have any questions? It's all good if you don't, but I just realized I haven't given you a chance.
No, yet. This is very much a just listen and learn sort of episode for me.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
We're coming close to the end of time on this, but I would love to ask you, Mike, if you can stick around, how you would approach if you were somebody like us and we thought, you know, maybe we'd like to adapt this to a graphic novel. If that's a really terrible idea, or how we would do that.
That's a great
approach
question,
it, or at least get started. And we probably should do that in another episode, or do you want to do that now, Jed?
Yeah, maybe we'll break and we'll do that in next week's episode. That sounds
okay.
Good. If that's all right with you, Mike.
Cool.
What a cliffhanger. Absolutely.
Awesome. All right. Well, yes, there we go. To be continued. This has been amazing. Like, yeah. Mike, I feel like I could hear you talk for days. Yeah, thank you everybody for listening or watching. We'll be back next week, so be sure to subscribe if you haven't already, and we'll continue this conversation with Mike Carey. Also, just a special shout out to our latest patron. Let me get their name up. Insert elevator music while the web page loads.
I should.
We have 32 people on Patreon now, which is pretty sick. So thank you everybody for helping to support the show. I'm stalling.
Is it Steve?
Someone,
I bet it's Steve.
Dude, distracting music.
while he's stalling, Mike, I just want to tell you that I did pass on your email address to my sister, and she goes, "No, I can't email him. He'll think I'm fangirling." And I was like, every time I
talk.
He says, "That's what I do every time I see Mike. I fangirl."
That would be, it would
and
be
this
cool
is
too,
why.
Cool to talk.
All right. I've got the Patreon name up. So thank you for waiting. So just want to shout out Ben Lee for joining the Patreon, and also an extra special shout out to Talon, who has joined our like highest tier legendary wizard level of our Patreon. So
awesome.
Thank you very much for that.
Yeah.
And yeah, if you want to check out the Patreon. Oh, there you go. Mike Carey's giving you a clap. So that's a bonus we didn't promise. Delivering above and beyond.
Mike gave him the clap.
That's it. The sign of approval.
I deny everything.
Wow. Fletcher waits, says nothing the entire episode, and then as usual comes out with gold at the last second.
Yeah. Yep.
It's my
just
job.
Like a classic writer.
I'm here to look pretty and drop one-liners.
Awesome. All right. We'll be back next week, and we'll see you then. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Cheers. Cheers, guys.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the podcast. If you want to help support the show and get access to exclusive episodes that you can't get anywhere else, head on over to our Patreon. That's patreon.com/wizardswarriorswords, and you can find the link down below. And an extra special shout out to our high-tier patron, Talon.